The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So good morning, and I also have a few announcements. One is that Diane Tatro, who has been hosting the potlucks here at IMC for over 10 years, I believe, back in, before we even moved here, ready to stop doing it. And so we're looking for someone else. It's a great contribution to our community to be the host for the Sunday once a month, end of the month potlucks. And I don't think it's too demanding, but it means a little bit supervising the event so that things get set up and properly, and then things get cleaned up at the end properly, and kind of supervising it all. So it's kind of like being the grand, gracious host for the rest of us in our practice community for that particular event. Diane said that if someone would like to do it, it's not required to make the monthly announcements that she does. If you're shy and don't want to stand in front and say there's now potluck or potluck next week, you don't have to do it. Someone else can do that. But if anybody is interested in doing that for the community, be very much appreciated, and you can talk to me or talk to Hillary, who's not here today, the volunteer coordinator for us. Another announcement is that Steve Gastner here is sitting on a chair that is different from all the other chairs. he knew to find it today. And we're testing it because we're creating this retreat center, and we need to have chairs in the meditation hall, and so we want to choose chairs that would work well. And a fair amount of research has gone into chairs, and we've also have many years' experience with the chairs here, and we realize that probably these chairs don't work so well. So we're going to try another chair as well. But if some of you want to try out the chair, you can ask Steve to step off and after the Dharma talk and try it. But also, there's an idea now that maybe we should also replace these chairs with those as well. And I know some people, for long sits, it's a little bit hard, these chairs, and people use cushions. And I tried this chair out recently on Friday or something the other day, and sat and enjoyed it and all that. And then I moved over and sat in one of our old chairs, and the contrast was shocking to me. I said, we're giving these to some... I hadn't realized somehow until I saw the contrast, what you guys are sitting on. Maybe we should keep those chairs so it motivated you to learn how to sit on the floor. It's very comfortable, But anyway, if you would like to try out that chair later and tell us what you think and whether you think that will work for here as well, it would be nice information to have from you. And then...
Bruce will be here, and they could tell Bruce.
Yeah, so Bruce Friedman is where? Is he... He's in the outer hall. So he's out there. He's kind of in that burgundy shirt and beard and smiles a lot. And he's happy, or at least willing, to take all the information about you wanted to tell him about the chair, your opinions. And what else? Then the last thing is that I won't be here for the next series of Sundays in August. And there will be a series of other speakers who will come and speak. You'll be well taught, I'm sure. Okay, so as a way into today's talk, I'd like to read you the opening verses of the Dhammapada. I'm a little bit fond of pointing out that there is no opening words to the Buddhist Bible, the Buddhist scriptures, but if anything was the opening words, like the opening of Genesis is the beginning of the Bible, it would be these verses here. And the contrast between how the book of Genesis begins with focusing on God stands out with how this beginning of the Buddhist scriptures begin not by focusing on God, but rather focusing on your own mind, a different source, a different beginning. And Buddhism, in a sense, it all begins with your mind, as opposed to, I suppose, in Genesis, it all begins with God. So, you know, different theology, different approach, maybe. So this, this first two verses go like this. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows, as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never-departing shadow. So here the emphasis on the role of the mind. And experience here means that what you experience. The experience is not something external from you, but has to do with the interplay between the world that you're in and your relationship to how you perceive it and interact with it contributes to what you call the experience, your experience you have. And all your experience here in Buddhism is somehow made by the mind. The mind has a really important role in this. And then this very significant statement where if you speak and act, if your mind behaves a certain way, if it's here the word is corrupted, this will bring suffering. Suffering follows. And the image here is of a ox that's pulling a cart. The ox is, imagine a cart that's full of rocks, really heavy. It's a lot of work for the ox to pull the cart. And so there's the image of kind of being burdened or being, you know, kind of suffering. And it's pulling along the cart. The cart will follow directly. The weight will follow you. The karma will follow you. And then the second one is if you speak or act with a mind that's peaceful, a different kind of mind, that has a different effect on you. There's a different result. And here it says happiness follows. And the image here is not one of being heavy and weighed down, but the image of a never-departing shadow. It still follows you around, but there's no burden to have a shadow. Most people are not burdened by shadows. It just follows in light, weightless way. It's easy. And so that happiness follows that way. So the weight of your suffering and the lightness of happiness, depending on how your mind functions. So this is an important verse in Buddhism. And it lends itself to a variety of different interpretations. And how you interpret something like this is important to consider. Because the act of interpretation could be done with a corrupted mind or a peaceful mind. So the very instructions here, in a sense, is even if you're going to interpret this or use these sets of verses, look and see how your mind is relating to it, how it's holding it. So I don't know if you prefer the word corrupted, but if you go along with it, if you're willing to go along with it for right now, if you latch on to this teaching in a hard and fast and dogmatic way, and maybe a frightened way, and say, uh-oh, I better not act corrupted. No one should be corrupted. And now I can't do those bad things. And now I have to be a good person and be a peaceful person. And now I have to be on my guard and I have to tighten up and just, okay, now I got to be a good Buddhist. From the point of view of these verses, that would be a corrupted mind. To relate that way, because it's a mind that tightens up, that reacts, that gets stiff, that narrows the possibilities for us. Another interpretation, another approach would be to react against it. What do these Buddhists know? You know, and corrupted, you know, they're so puritanical, these words, and, you know, and this emphasis on the mind, and everything made by the mind, and how could that be, you know, and protest, that's another way. But if you look at the mind that's making that kind of evaluation, it's possible, if you look at it, that you'll see that reacting negatively also involves a contraction and a stiffness and a hardness, which it doesn't feel so good to have. A third approach would be one of curiosity, one of saying, well, how does this work? What is this about? This is an interesting statement. Gill made this very dramatic opening statement about how this contrasts with the book of Genesis. And, you know, that was a big thing to say, and he probably doesn't know anything about the book of Genesis, but it's still important for him to make that statement. So what is it about this? What is it about this verse? What is it about this teaching? It focuses on the mind. So how is this true in some ways for me? How could I look at my mind? Can I see this working in my mind? What is my mind? The mind is so important here. What is this mind? I wonder what it is. What goes on in my mind? And here it talks about two different functions of the mind. It makes a dichotomy or a distinction between what here is called corrupted and peaceful. Are there distinctions? Are there different ways that my mind functions? What happens if I'm curious about this and open up and look at it? To approach these verses with that kind of curiosity lends itself to being more open, a sense of wonder, a sense of possibility, a sense of like, let's look at, there's many possibilities, let's find out. And the suggestion I have here is that kind of approach to being curious, to wondering what's going on, to looking, what's happening here? Stepping back and being curious as opposed to locking in for or against these kinds of statements. In that curiosity, in that wondering, in that opening to possibility, what is here, is found freedom, is found some kind of peaceful mind. A kind of peaceful mind is found by being curious, interested, not reactive, not clinging to something. So the tendency in Buddhism, the emphasis, in this, especially in our school of Buddhism, is to keep turning the attention back and look at the quality of the mind, the activity of the mind, and the consequences of that activity. And how do you hold beliefs like Buddhist teachings? How you hold them, it may be less important for us than what you believe. Because you can hold, you can resist teachings, you could be dogmatic and fundamentalist holding on to teachings, religious teachings really tight, or you can have teachings, and how you hold them could be one of, this is interesting, this makes me curious, this makes me want to wonder, what's going on here? Let me see how it works, let me see what's going on. And so the teachings are held in a very open, light way that facilitates the sense of wonder or investigation or a sense of exploring what's possible. So there was a, 2 weeks ago I gave a talk here on willpower. And after I gave the talk, someone sent me a Scientific American article on willpower. And it was a very interesting article, a little article. And it referred to an experiment, psychological experiment that had been done, where two sets of people were given the same puzzle, problem to solve. It was kind of an anagram. It was like they gave them a word, and the puzzle was to figure out what other words can you make with the letters of that word? So they divided into two groups, and one group, they said to them, you're going to do this experiment. This is what you're going to do, is to figure out what other words you can make from this. The other group, they asked something like, they said to them, spend a little bit of time now wondering what it would be like to do this kind of puzzle. One group, they said, you will do the puzzle. The other group, they said something more like, would you be willing to do this puzzle? And then they did the puzzle and they saw the results. And the people who were instructed to wonder more, or to open-ended, would you be willing to do this? Or what would it be like for you to do this? Scored much higher on the experiment. Those who were told, you will do this, scored not as well. And the theory, or the kind of that the researchers had as a result from this, was that the idea of being willing opens the mind for greater possibilities, makes the mind wonder more. The idea of you will tightens things up, and then you will do it. And so the role of willingness, how the mind is. And maybe we don't want to call strong will corrupted, but strong when you have a strong kind of tight determination, this has to be this way. Even in practice, in meditating, this has to be this way. I have to get focused and concentrated. You narrow the possibilities and you lose a certain kind of freedom. But if you come with the question of what would it be like to get concentrated? What would it be like to explore and get to know the mind? What would it be like? What's it like to be mindful? I'm supposed to be mindful. I have to be mindful or else there's disaster is going to happen. What would it be like? What is this mind? So the approach of practice, I think, that of mindfulness that really helps is to have more sense of this willingness, open curiosity. What is this mind? What goes on in this mind? What happens in this mind? And so if we start looking at our mind, and there's a number of areas that I think is helpful to investigate and get to know. The nice trick about this is that as you're wondering and looking in your own mind, you're in the present moment. But now you're in the present moment with a sense of curiosity and interest as opposed to a sense of duty. So maybe it's a little bit easier sometimes in a sense of duty. Or maybe it's not as easy to be in the present moment with that open wondering in the short term. But maybe in the long term, you can sustain it much longer and settle into it. To be too willful and kind of, I got to do this, takes a lot of extra effort and energy. That's a strain that will wear you down after a while. And then you have to kind of tighten up even more. But if you have this more sense of wonder, and like, what's going on here? Your mind might wander more, a little bit in the beginning, but it might be more sustainable and you settle down over time to become more focused and concentrated. So what goes on? So to look at the mind, what's going on here? One of the really interesting things to look at, be mindful of, is what it's like for your mind to be not concentrated. What it's like for your mind not to be mindful. What's it like for the mind not to be present? What's going on for you? Be curious. What is a thinking mind like? Usually it's because people are thinking a lot. And so instead of thinking, I got to stop thinking, get focused here, because that narrows things, but rather, what is this thinking mind about? What's happening to me as I think? And then perhaps let go of it with the question, what happens if I let go? What happens if I'm not so focused on my thoughts? As opposed to, I shouldn't be focused on my thoughts, I'm supposed to be free of thoughts. But what happens if I let go? Maybe it's easier for the mind to be willing to let go a little bit. My wife, I told this my wife this morning a little bit about this experiment, and she said to me, she read recently in this book on willpower. She's read further than I had, so there's a chapter here. It talks about people who diet. Dieting is a big issue for many people. And then, and there's a very huge percentage of dieting failures, right? People who say, "I'm going to diet," and I'm going to, and then they can't keep it up. So they did experiments, so they studied people who diet, and they found that they look at three groups of people: the people who weren't going to diet at all, the people who were determined they're going to diet and eat better or whatever. And the third group was the ones who approached the dieting was, I'm not going to eat this now, but I'm going to do it later. And then they studied, who had the best success in dieting or eating less or whatever. And it's the people who said later that had the greater success. I'm going to put it off for later. The people who said, I'm not going to do this. And if, it lends itself to being fixed and tight. I'm not going to be resistant. And perhaps the mind then, it takes a lot of effort and energy for the mind to do that. Then it involves resistance and struggle, which when you're struggling, it takes a lot of energy, a lot of effort. And a human being can't sustain endless effort. And so at some point we give in. But if you ask, but if you say later, it takes less willpower, it takes less effort and energy to say later because you're not resisting it so much. And then later, chances are you're not going to do it. the wave of desire and and you know is past. I mean, I've had desires for food, and it seemed like it was pretty imperative to have that ice cream. Like now, the most important thing in the world. I see it with my kids. It has to be now. But then, and 10 minutes later, and half an hour later, an hour later, I hardly remember that I had that desire. A day later, I don't even remember I had the ice cream. So the idea of later, you know, so it's not so tight. So to look at the, so in meditation, how does this translate? What does this mean in meditation? To look at the mind and see what's going on and not have a fixed idea, it has to be this way. I have to have a concentrated mind. Or I can't be this kind of person. I can't be this kind of way. If everyone here knew what I was thinking during meditation, you know, it would just be certainly embarrassing, but they'd know that I shouldn't be in a Buddhist center, right? You know, this is bad. But the approach of this, you know, to have those, that's all approaches which are counterproductive, that tightens us up. What happens if the approach is more curiosity and wonder? What is this mind? How does it work? And what is it like if I let go for a little while? I can't say, stop thinking. Like, I can't diet, so I'm not going to start dieting. But you can say, I'm going to think about this later. Maybe this is good that I'm thinking about, but I'll think about it later. As opposed to no. After meditation, I'll think about it. Maybe that's more conducive, more helpful for the mind to be relaxed and calm and open up and be willing to open up into the present moment in a fuller way. And so we'll start looking at the mind and looking at what's going on. So one of the interesting things to look at with thinking, since thinking is often what people struggle with in meditation, is to look at the difference between a mind that's involved in thinking and a mind that's not caught up in thinking. And so that study, that investigation works best if you have a little bit of a contrast, a visceral kind of, you can experience, you have an experienced contrast between when your mind is calm and settled and not so caught up in thought and when your mind is caught up in thought. To see that difference. And sometimes if you're lucky enough, settled enough, you can notice your mind is caught up in thinking, you're involved in thinking, that's what you're absorbed in. And then perhaps you can let go of it enough that you see what it's like when your mind is not caught up in it. And some people report the difference this way, that when the mind is caught up, obsessed with thinking, involved and lost in its thoughts, there's a way in which the mind seems darkened, narrowed, constricted, tight, lost on itself. But when the mind switches to let go of those obsessions, not be so locked into those thoughts, but becomes more mindful, more lets go of them, the mind feels more light in the mind, luminosity in the mind, openness in the mind, space in the mind, clarity of the mind, peacefulness of the mind. The experience of our own mind changes whether we're caught up in what we're thinking about or not caught up in it. And that contrast is very interesting, to be curious. What's this like? And then, where do you want to be? What would you rather have your mind be? You'd rather have the mind being dark and caught up and constricted, or would you rather have it open and light and more spacious? That question, I think, not to say you should one or the other, but to have that question, what is it better for me? What is more useful? What is more pleasant? What's more enjoyable? What feels freer? At some point, people who are meditators, I think, begin asking this question, because as you begin getting into meditation, you have start understanding that you have a greater range of possibilities of how to conduct your mind, how your mind can be. And so rather than being kind of stuck with the mind that you have every day, you know, going through your life, you realize that there are other options for how you can be with your mind. And so then perhaps you can begin, not because you should choose to do them, but because it's nicer to choose to do them, you start choosing a more peaceful way of being, a more open way of being. So that's one way of thinking. Another thing is your desires, to notice how you relate to desire. What's it like when you're in the grips of a desire? And what's it like when you're not in the grips of it? What's the quality of the mind? What's the possibilities of the mind one way versus the other way? What happens when you're in the grip of hate and aversion, ill will? And what happens when, in contrast, when you're not? What's the quality of the mind then? What's the situation of the mind then? And what are the consequences of the mind that's caught in desire? What's the consequence of the mind that's caught in ill will? And what's the consequence of the mind which is not? So it's a stepping back and wondering, what is this like? What's going on here? What's happening? And in that wondering, in the stepping back and being curious, there is greater autonomy, greater freedom, and greater choice, which in and of itself feels better, feels good. To live a life that has very little choice, very little autonomy, doesn't feel so good from the point of view of stepping back and having autonomy. From the point of view of being lost in your obsessions, it can seem like your obsessions and your beliefs and your desires and your aversions is the most important thing in the world. But if you step back, then maybe you realize that there's a better quality, a greater happiness, a peaceful mind that leads to greater happiness. So how do we relate to the mind? How do we understand the mind? How would you like your mind to conduct itself and to be? What is a useful way of being in your mind? When you sit down to meditate, do you sit down? How do you sit down? What's your attitude as you sit down to meditate? Do you have a should? Do you have a requirement? Do you have a black and white thing, like, I can't do this, I have to be this way? Or do you sit down with more of a sense of curiosity and interest, and what is this going on? What's happening? How is it functioning now, my mind? What is going on now? How would it be if I run some experiments in the mind? What happens if I let go of thoughts? What happens if I, study and investigate the nature of my desire as opposed to being in it? What happens? Let me look at this. Let me explore. Let me get to know. And then the last thing I'll say then is the idea that behind all this perhaps is a willingness to be present, a willingness to explore, a willingness to be concentrated, a willingness to be mindful, as opposed to a willfulness for it. But it's not one way or the other. I think one of the great things is once you get appreciate the peacefulness and the autonomy and the freedom that's found in a willingness and an openness and a wonder, then you can be very dedicated and vigilant and willful to stay willing. And rather than it being exhausting, it helps the mind be refreshed, because what you're committed to is a mind that's at ease. And so there can be a very powerful resolve and commitment to stay in the place of ease, to stay in that place of openness, of wonder. Without that strong commitment, constricting or narrowing or darkening the mind, but rather supporting the mind staying open and peaceful and present. Make some sense? So that's what I had. And I'm wondering what some of you think now of that. So is there a mic over here on that side?
So I'm wondering, since we're on the topic of the mind, what it is. I used to think for a long time that the mind was the brain. And now I think the mind is everywhere in my body.
Yeah. Now, so, you know what, maybe it's a little entry point to this question is to say the brain is the hardware and the mind is the software. And so, software can change. And you have to go to the store to get new hardware, but but generally humans don't get more new hardware for their brain. They're kind of like you're given the you have, you know, Author 2.0 or whatever. And but you can get new software, and so the mind in Buddhism is not a thing. It's not a, you know, it's not the brain, but rather it's a series of processes. It's a process, it's an activity. And so it's the activity, that's why it's more like the operating of the software. It's the activity of how, what goes on in the mind. And the activity and the process of the mind are malleable and can change. You're not stuck with how those are. An important part of Buddhist spirituality is beginning to help the mind become more malleable than it is, because sometimes the processes get locked into grooves. And there's, you know, when there's attachment, then the mind is not so flexible, and so the processes are not so flexible. But as people relax and open up and are more mindful, the mental processings become more malleable and softer. And then as they become malleable and softer, then it's also possible to begin choosing to strengthen certain processes of the mind and weaken others. And so part of Buddhist spirituality is to support those processes of mind that that lead to greater wisdom and freedom. So things like developing more loving kindness, more compassion, more mindfulness, more patience, more generosity, all these kinds of things can be done in such a way that they support the softening, the opening, the loosening up of the processes. Things like hate and greed tend to gum up the system. Does that make some sense?
We can thank our ancestors.
We can thank our ancestors, that's for sure, because we've evolved these amazingly powerful minds that have a lot of different capacities. And there's a lot of multiple processes that are within us. And so the question is, which of these processes do we want to emphasize? We've evolved probably because at some point or other it was really useful to be greedy and have hate. Probably it helped certain tribes survive. But we also evolved to have tremendous generosity and nurturing and compassion and warmth, because that also probably helped people survive. But somehow it all got mixed in together, right? So in there, because probably what was best for our ancestors was to have in the village people who could do all kinds of things depending on what was needed. But so we're multifunctional. And the question is, which of our inner functions do you want to give precedence to? Which are the most useful to develop and cultivate? And asking that question is the beginning of a process of stepping back and not being enmeshed in your mind. So you know, stepping back and, you know, becoming autonomous, even autonomous from your own mind, is a very important step in Buddhism. You know, I'm watching children grow up, and it's fascinating to watch them become more autonomous. And you know, year by year, month by month, sometimes you see this greater capacity to be autonomous, first from their parents, you know, and then from, you know, their own feelings and emotions and desires. And then also, you know, at a certain age, kids become autonomous a little bit from the moment, too. Thank God. These kids sometimes are too much in the present moment. And so they're not kind of locked into the present moment anymore, so that's good. And then at some point, they have the ability to self-reflect and to kind of realize that, and, you know, see their thoughts and feelings and desires and start becoming more autonomous with them. And everything's not so consequential in the way it was before. And so this process of autonomy can continue, and that's what Buddhist practice is partly doing, is continuing that momentum of growth, of human development, so that at some point we have the capacity to be autonomous from our own mind. Isn't that nice? And then the question is, you know, if there's something which is autonomous from your own mind, what is that? Don't ask the question. So, someone else, maybe one more, and then we'll stop for our potluck. Yes, please. Can you use the mic, please?
If all the decisions are made by the mind, then what is the role of the soul?
What's the role of the soul? I don't know what the soul is. What is soul for you?
Soul is the consciousness inside me.
The soul is the consciousness inside of you?
Yes.
So, and what's the role of your consciousness?
It's It's always preventing me in many ways.
It's always what?
It's always stopping me in many ways.
It's always helping you in many ways.
Helping me, stopping me to do something wrong.
Oh, so your consciousness is not only being something that is conscious and aware, but it's also helping make decisions.
Yes.
But you distinguish between consciousness and your mind?
Yes.
How come?
Because your mind wants many things. Your mind is always behind money, behind desire, behind lust, behind pride, behind greed. But somewhere it's your conscious that judges what's right and wrong.
Uh-huh.
Your mind is always wandering around.
So in the classic Buddhist psychology, what you're calling consciousness would be considered part of the mind, because the mind has these different functions. But that mindfulness, for example, has that function. The greater mindfulness you have, the more wisdom you have to make these decisions and distinguish and have choice. One of the interesting distinctions to be made is between that part of the mind that's involved in identifying me and I, and that part of the mind can function without that strong identification. And so it's possible to have be conscious and aware without the extra added on, I'm the one who's aware, that I'm what's going on. But it's still a functioning of the mind to have that.
So you say that both yes and no are inside the mind?
Yes and no is inside the mind?
Uh-huh. Or yes is in the mind and no is in the soul?
Say it again, please.
Are both yes and no in the mind, or is it just yes in the mind and no in the soul? I can give you an example. If I want to go and do a robbery, my mind says yes, but somewhere my soul stops me from doing a robbery because it says it's not a good thing to rob.
Yeah, so in Buddhism, it's all happening within the mind, these things, but we have a different relationship. There's different functionings of the mind functioning in different ways. And so just like brain scientists will point out that there are different neurological centers in the brains where different things operate and different things happen. So my guess is if you put a person underneath a CAT scan or something and studied their brain activity, you'd see that the person who was deciding to, that when the decision is made to go rob a bank, certain parts of the brain light up. And when another part of the brain lights up that sees that you're doing that and decides not to do that. So a different part of the brain is functioning. And what scientists have seen is that when people are doing identifying and selfing, making self stories about themselves, it lights up a particular part of the brain. And they've done experiments with people, having them meditate, where they'll show them a screen of what their own brain is doing. And when there's self-referential thinking going on, it's shown that happens. And so when people can watch the self-referential thinking externally by seeing their brains light up, it's much easier for them to get more peaceful in meditation. Because then they see, the self-referential thinking is the very thing that's popped me out of being calm. There's a consequence and the cost of being self-referential. It's a certain activity of the mind. But if I don't do that activity, I can be more peaceful. And so by seeing, getting that biofeedback system, they can do. So in Buddhism, there's no need to posit a soul as something external from the mind. There's just this different, but it's a beautiful concept that there is this part of the mind that has wisdom and has ability to make choices that are different than the egotistical mind, or different than the greedy mind, or the reptilian brain, or something like that. And how useful it is to label it as a soul, distinct from everything else, Buddhism has some doubts about, because the concept of soul lends itself to a magnet for a lot of other beliefs and ideas, and lends itself to kind of a not-so-useful hard separation between all the different functions of the mind. So the tendency in Buddhism is not to use the word soul. But it's okay. Okay, so So we have a potluck now, and we have the end of the month, and everyone's invited to stay. Some of you maybe didn't know and are new here today. Please stay. You're welcome to be part of it. And since we do have this potluck today, and we have a couple of minutes before it formally starts, it would be nice if for those of you who have been here before, if you see someone around you who you don't recognize or never said hello to, if you said hello before we break for the potluck or to leave. So please introduce yourself to someone. It's a nice thing to do. Thank you.